Shop Maniacs, you're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about front end web design and development. I'm Dave, March 240th. Rupert, and with me is Chris, getting a new office choir.
Of all the weeks you didn't do a spooky intro, Dave, this one's going to come out.
Sorry.
Like right by Halloween.
I really meant to be a Dracula again. I'm still, I'm out of it, dude. Hey, I did.
You know what I'm going to dress up as, I think? I'm going to dress up as a select element that's not really a select element, you know?
Oh, like you'll probably only have one outfit unless something changes about that soon.
But I can colorize it any way I want to color it. All I do is just use some tie-dye, some paint, and then I have a color how I want it, you know?
Hey, Chris, how does that relate to the show?
Well, this is going to be great. This is going to be a show. I think we're going to end up talking a lot about evolving the web platform. You know, the web platform just being a kind of a hand-wavy term, meaning just like browsers in general, the internet, all that. It's, you know, use the platform. That is what people say. And I buy into that. I'm a web platform kind of guy. I think we all are here. The web is good to this darn world. And so what I mean by evolving the web platforms, we're going to talk about changing stuff, like the process of changing the fundamentals of the platform, meaning APIs and stuff, but also CSS, HTML, JavaScript, you know, stuff that you know, I'm sure you're all aware of, changes slowly over time, but it changes very deliberately. And so we're going to talk about some of that deliberation, I guess. And this is a complicated process. It has to do with standards bodies and all the people over there that do stuff. There's going to be developers involved, like squeaky wheels, like Dave and I. there's going to be browser vendor people and the whole complicated stew of people involved over there. Our guest knows that world better than anyone else, probably. Our guest is Greg Whitworth. Hey, Greg.
Hello.
Hey. Let's just do this part first. You were at Microsoft for a long time. You're at Salesforce now, right?
Yep.
Cool. And so you're now... you're like not a browser vendor anymore, unless Salesforce is going to build a browser, which I wouldn't put it past them, you know?
Yeah, not right now, not that I'm aware of, but yeah, yeah. I'm. It's been kind of interesting kind of coming to the other side of the fence after 7 years, you know, on the platform team over at Edge.
Yeah, literally, they call it the platform team. That's cool. So you're now, but you're still involved in the web process. So now you're kind of like an outside influencer almost. Something.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, a lot of people may not know it, but there's a large desire for that. So it puts you in a potentially good position because the majority of people, as you hit on, in the standards bodies are browser vendors. So it's a good angle to come in from. Yeah.
We had a show with Brian Cardell as well. He kind of lives in this world a little bit too, although with a company that's kind of very specifically about, you know, this
implementation.
Yeah, implementation. Yeah. With Egalia, did I say it right?
Yeah.
Cool. So he's similar. He's a Greg Whitworth-esque person in the world. Cool. So, but one of the things that we have to talk about, we'll probably spend the most of the time talking about, is form controls, which is a subject I think near and dear to your heart. You've been working on it for a long time, right?
Yeah. So basically where this started we on the move to Chromium from Edge, and basically we did a ridiculous massive Excel spreadsheet, as you would at Microsoft, of all the things that we thought our end users would be missing and would be losing. And one of them happened to be we actually continually invested and kept our form controls up to date for different form factors and, you know, accessibility and, you know, look and feel. And Chrome did not. So that was one area. So we started kind of, you know, updating those.
So the second Edge goes Chromium, you're probably going to gain some stuff and you're going to lose some stuff. And in the losing column was worse form controls.
Yeah. Well, and if you remember, we have a massive, Microsoft has a massive amount of dual factor devices. And so touch is actually very, very important. And almost all the form controls were not touch friendly in any manner.
Ooh. Wow. Okay.
Not to mention accessibility is like a massive. So like if you think high contrast, for example, which is the most used accessibility feature, none of them had, you know, high contrast support out of the box.
All those things.
Yeah.
So there's work to be done on form controls. Now, where my ears perk up, and all that stuff perks up my ears too. You know, like it's not interested sure. there, but there's this kind of more day to day in my world thing where it's like there's HTML elements that we all know, love, and use sometimes, like literally a select dropdown, an angle bracket select. I'm talking about an HTML, and you click it and a bunch of things open and you can select one of them and rock and roll, right? But then there's this like proliferation of people that have decided to rebuild that essentially exact same thing. And they did it for reasons. And that's another aspect of what I'm sure what we'll end up getting into today is like why are they doing that? What does the research suggest? What's an alternative to that? What's the future of that? And why do we care at all? And I know you have a blog post about this that really digs into like the data and what our developers saying about this kind of thing. So do you want to go there?
I'll go wherever you want, man. I could probably spend 3 hours talking about this. So wherever you want to direct me, I'll talk.
Okay, so we've set the stage. We know that at the genesis of this, you're at Edge, your web platform. You're concerned about form controls and wanting to evolve them. And also about this, just the squeaky wheels like me in the world that are just like, why can't we style form elements?
I actually think that's an important one to hit on, because what was interesting about it, and it's a correct question to ask, is when we were working on these and we were putting all that time and energy into, the design teams, both at Google and at Microsoft working together on what to make, the defaults kind of look like and experiences. Upper management correctly asked, why are we spending time on this? Because I don't ever see these anywhere. So it was one of those things that like, yeah, they should be default, but should we be really putting the rigor and polish to make them this great when I don't see them all, on the top web properties? And I think that kind of hit the nail on the head with regards to the status quo of just, this is how it's always been. And it has like, 30 years now, you've never been into your point of that select. You've never been able to style it. So,
So you're saying like Wikipedia doesn't have selects on it. YouTube doesn't have selects on them.
Well, they're still highly used, but a lot of times there's like hacks to like make it so you don't actually see them, or you only get the pop-up, or like you actually have an article that I reference quite often with the checkbox hack where it's like, sure, technically you're using the input type checkbox, but you're not. Like you're just basically using the model to send via forms, right? Like you're using it. And then the thing that ended up coming out of that is we were doing external and internal interviews across different major web properties. And like at Microsoft alone, we found 7 different component library teams. So just, do the math on money there. And then like when you scale that out, just look at, so now I'm at Salesforce. We have an entire team devoted to it. Like just, you can just do the math on how much money across the industry is being spent redoing literally the exact same thing that ships in the platform, but due to specific gaps to your point. So I will now let you direct it, but I just did want to hit on kind of the dollar and cents and how there is this like built-in status quo of
things are fine. Just at Microsoft, if you fix this, you'd make money, let alone the entire industry together. So how interesting. Where I think of it, and I know Dave thinks about accessibility a lot too, that's a big angle to this, because the perhaps the biggest talking point that I hear is, okay, fine, I'll rebuild a select element. How hard can it be? The implementations that you see of that around the you've probably seen 100 of them in your life. They're almost always bad. It's really hard to get it right from all the perspectives, and mostly from the accessibility one. Does it work with the keyboard? Does it work with the mouse correctly? There's a laundry list of stuff that in order to perfectly replicate a select is difficult to do and often just isn't done.
Well, yeah, and it actually goes well beyond that. And like, that's kind of why I would point to that survey data, because all the browser vendors, it becomes untenable. And this is something that we kept trying to reiterate with people, you know, I would say in power positions that can say yes or no to a team spending time on it is, you know, it's very easy for a browser vendor to say, oh, well, they should go test my browser and they should be testing this AT. And it's like, but then when you look at a browser matrix and you say, okay, well, I need to support Safari and I need to support Mozilla and Chrome and Edge and, you know, pick any matrix you want of in versions, and then say, oh, okay, now I'll go test high contrast of this control. I'll test keyboard support of this control. I'll test. And then what's funny is people say accessibility, but like every AT, so assistive technology, so think Narrator, VoiceOver, NVDA, any of those, they are browsers themselves. Ultimately, they have their own implementations. So in order to truly know those, you need to be testing those. James Craig in a recent call I thought was wonderful from Apple was like, hey, you know, I bet you none of these sites are testing Braille devices, but like the browser vendors do. And so that's a perfect thing of like, hey, I want to change this arrow on my select. And in order to change that, I'm throwing away all of that energy and those relationships between those assistive technologies and the browsers solely to change that like arrow.
I have I have an accessibility audit like right in front of me. Here's the platforms they tested on: Android TalkBack, Windows Dragon Eyes, or like Windows Dragon, which is like where you talk at the screen and it does things. High contrast, Windows High Contrast, the Windows Narrator, Windows Zoom Text, which is like text magnifier, I think, zooming in like 1,000% or whatever. iOS VoiceOver and Mac VoiceOver. This is just one audit I have in front of me, but
it's a lot.
I think it's eight different platforms times whatever, five different browsers.
And then all of those have different modes to traverse. Like some will do like, yeah, like we could, again, like I said, we could spend an hour talking about probably each of these subtopics. But yeah, accessibility is one of the number ones we called out from an end user pain point perspective.
Well, here's a quick thing though, that if you then just use a select and you're not doing anything fancy, it's a form, it's got a select in it, there's some degree of like comfort there, isn't it? Like all these browser support matrix crap, it kind of, in my mind, goes away because you're like, I'm not doing anything fancy here. I'm just doing the thing. And I expect these browser implementations to do it correctly. Now, I know there might be nuance there and some of them might not, but I'm kind of expecting if I just use a form and a select element, nothing fancy, I don't get involved in any other way, that's just going to work and doesn't really require testing.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Or like a pass through. But like, yeah, it's definitely not what Dave just listed out.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and it's, I don't know. For me, it's like an NPM package that comes in the browser. It's like, I don't have to test the NPM package. I just have to write the code.
Exactly.
But you should test the code that they do. But anyway.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by WooCommerce. WooCommerce being the, you know, free open source plugin that goes on your free open source WordPress install. That is if you self-install. You know, you can run WooCommerce essentially is like what powers the e-commerce on WordPress.com as well, but it's all just kind of like, you know, built in and they help you along in that process. Totally a good way to go too, by the way. Do you know I have a bunch of sites on WordPress.com? Like if there's just like a simple blog, like I have this like emailisgood.com one that I run, and I have some for some silly side projects that I run that I'm like, I don't want any technical debt, but I want a nice blog that I control. I do that on WordPress.com. But anyway, this is not a part of that necessarily. This is like, let's say you want to sell something, do e-commerce on your WordPress site that's not on WordPress.com, like a self-install one, which I have even more of those. For example, CSStricks.com. I have WooCommerce on there, and I have on and off over the years, but I can't see ever turning it off now because it's been so good to us, especially over the last, whatever, 6-8 months, I've been using it more. One of the things I wanted to do was have subscriptions for the site that was like low-key, low technical debt and low maintenance for me, because if I bite, sometimes I bite too big on something, I'm not ready to do it. Like I'm not a one-man e-commerce shop. I don't like make, you know, I don't know, purses or walking sticks or anything that I'm trying to sell to people. In this case, what I wanted to sell on CSS Tricks right out of the gate was kind of like a membership. And I called it MVP Supporter, because that's what you really are when you sign up for this on CSS Tricks. It's just like a, hey, thanks kind of thing. Because I get emails once in a while, people like literally asking to do that. Hey, can I buy you a beer kind of thing, which is extremely generous and extremely awesome. Now there's a way to do it. You sign up for as MVP Supporter on CSS Tricks, and I try to do some stuff on the site for you. For example, I rounded up all of my favorite CSS tricks, made them into a quote unquote book that you can read on the site. Really, they're blog posts, and I think it's better that way anyway, because then they're interactive and they have links and all this stuff. You have access to read all of that great reference material, I hope, the best CSS trick, and you have access to it because I set up a subscription in WooCommerce on my WordPress site that does this, that gives you that access, that it ties in with the memberships plugin we use. So you get a subscription, which gives you a membership and makes the whole thing happen. Now, I also sell other things now with there. We drop ship some posters and products and stuff, and that's really cool. And of course, WooCommerce does that too, but I really dig the subscription thing. Very cool. Thanks so much, WooCommerce, for the support. So this is what you're coming at it, and now you're not at Microsoft, you're not on a web platform team, but you're kind of on a web platform team. Like, why does the Greg of today still care?
Because I've done web development, you know what, since 95 or whatever. This has been I would say it's primarily a passion project, but like as I said, Salesforce also has a team that does this, and so if we're able to make it so that these controls ultimately can live in the platform, everything Dave just listed out, we can alleviate, not completely, because, you know, again, you should still be testing your sites, but you don't need to be ensuring that, you know, keyboard up and down works on your select and, you know, tab management is correct and all that other stuff. You should just be like, hey, does the flow sound right? Does the internationalization work correctly and all that other stuff? It's not testing that sub piece over and over again.
Right. And so we've talked about selects because that's one of our favorites. And mm-hmm. your data suggests that select is one of the biggest targets just because it's rebuilt a lot. Isn't that what the data suggests?
And it is. Yeah. And it's the most probably outside of maybe date and color built in is probably one of the like most complex one, but it's the most recreated. And yeah, if you look at the most frustrating control, it's like near 50%, takes up 50% of the votes.
It's a big target.
Yeah.
But there's all kinds of stuff, right? There's, I don't know, search inputs, you know, like it doesn't that much interesting, but hey, it's there and it's got quirks too. And then it's suggested that if you take some big survey, you ask all these developers that do this stuff day to day, what do you want? And I ask this once in a while, only anecdotally on a much smaller scale. And even I definitely get answers that just vaguely say, just give me more ability to style form stuff. If you're a CSS person, like I just want it to just feel normal. Just want it to be like, I don't know, you know, that little X widget in the input type search? Like, why can't I style that thing? Give me a sensical CSS selector for it. Anyway, so wow, there's a lot there. So what if we don't do anything at all? That we covered this a little bit. The consequences then are what?
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, as we kind of hit on, everybody kind of goes and rebuilds them in their, you know, own little silos and takes their design and does their best to with their probably smaller teams and smaller. Weirdly enough, the argument I always see with regards to accessibility, you know, kind of trying to tell upper management that it's important, and convince them that it's important. And so like them taking the time to go build out a control that takes into effect all of those different things. One thing that's, with regards to accessibility, but then also again, just rebuilding it from, you just referenced the search one. Okay. So like to go rebuild that yourself, it's a very simple one, but okay, I need to go, you know, build a box, you know, make an asset. You know, like put it in there. And so like you're already like adding time where it's like I could have just put in like a pseudo element potentially, or, you know, at least just been able to like reach into that containing pseudo element that exists there and like swap out that content rather than recreate the entire thing.
Yeah. Well, a checkbox is also a huge one. You know, you already mentioned those a little bit, but you know, I remember working, you know, I was at SurveyMonkey a long time ago, and of course they changed it, and who knows what the original reasoning was, but they had a very iconic checkbox and radio button that were just really big. You know, they just were bigger, and the native ones have always been, I don't know, it feels like a little bit small, maybe built for the era of when things are, you know, mostly mouse cursor oriented. You know, sometimes you think of those little tiny checkboxes and you're like, that's not going to work on mobile. I need a big 44 by 44 pixel tap target.
And it was like 680 by 480 screen.
I was going to say the resolution
super zoomed in, right?
Yeah. And so, but then, and that's where, again, going back to those 30 year issues, like when we were redoing the Chromium ones, like then there's web compat. So like the layout kind of has to stay the same by default. So they stay these little tiny things so you don't break sites, you know?
Even though,
of course, like, you know, when we went to our designers, they were like, oh yeah, we have checkboxes from our design systems, you know, across Microsoft and Google, here's what they look like. And it's like, yeah, they're all those like 44 pixel ones, you know, for good touch targets and stuff. And it's like, all right, can you scale it down to like 15 pixels and just look terrible? Pretty
designers
much.
Love that. They love that.
Oh yeah.
That's
yeah.
the kind of work they love.
So if you just said, we're going to change the web platform such that you could apply a width and a height to input type equals checkbox, makes some kind of logical sense to that, but you're saying there's enough CSS out there on the planet that if you respected those values, all of a sudden you're going to have like breaking websites, and like that's kind of not cool in the world of
just doing that out of default of just saying, hey, weirdly enough, you mentioned this, I actually have an explainer open literally just for checkbox because I feel like it's a good starting point one to kind of get the ball rolling with this. And that's kind of one of the questions that's in my head of like, how do we make it so that that default can occur? And I'm currently thinking, leaning towards, you know, when appearance none is activated, but we'll have to go look at compat data and kind of see the overlap of, hey, when appearance none is there on a checkbox, as well as is width and height still there. So like, if we start respecting that, would that potentially break layouts and all that other stuff? But like, that's the kind of way I'm leaning right now, because appearance none is very, very vague in definition. And right. I don't want to get too far into this, but like my first initial draft will probably be like linking into that and saying, hey, if that's there, then hey, like you can have access to these properties that people have always wanted to touch. That isn't the case.
So interesting. And so all I can do is, you know, pontificate on things and let you go for it. But part of me is like, that makes a lot of sense as a first step. I think so. Because then you're wiping out, at least in my experience, I think that is what it's supposed to do or what it often does. And this is a CSS property and value, appearance none. It just kind of like wipes out what's there, like resets the control to like nothing, like BYO styles. So yeah, that would make sense to me.
It's very much like I'm shifting the car into manual. Like I'll take care of it is sort of how I.
So if that respected the height and width, sure. But then you're kind of on your own to bring something that looks checkbox-esque to the party, some background or some particular styling.
Yeah, that's where my explainer doesn't stop there. This is kind of where I don't want, again, I don't know necessarily how you see this discussion going, but that's kind of where like the open UI stuff comes in. I'll actually be proposing those, the anatomy that are defined there, and recommending those as like pseudo elements, because there was a, because then that kind of allows you to start doing what you were referencing with this search. With regards to, oh, I only want to change this one part. I actually don't want to like add a border or this, that, or the other. I actually just want to touch this, you know, just this part, or I want to adjust that. But like pseudo elements come with a ton of limitations that you have to like check, because you're kind of like, okay, well, to make it so that they can change the color. Okay, well, in order to do that, we then need to make it so they can never change what the X looks like. You better love, you know, the variability between, you know, like for example, at one point, you know, the X is a bad example, but if you were to like think of like a password reveal, like an eyeball, like those vary drastically across operating systems. And so if you better love the eyeballs that ship with those, you know, OSs and UAs, or browsers, because then you could change the color real easily, but you couldn't make it like match your brand. Like if you had a specific glyph you had for, eyes or X's or whatever. So
really a tight rope you got to walk.
All have to have big eyes with big eyelashes. It's in the brand. It's in this brand guide.
Yeah.
So with the checkbox, if we were speculating, it'd be like, well, okay, there's like the UI of like the square itself, you know, how rounded is it? What's the border? What's the background? Is there a gradient involved? Yada, yada.
Well, that's where I don't want to get into that. What I want to do is, and this is actually great. I'll just bounce it off of you all because I'm actively writing it and you can tell me if it's dumb or not. So yeah, basically what it would be doing is we have like a rough draft anatomy already in OpenUI, and basically checkbox currently has a, determinate, indeterminate states and like checked or unchecked, And so basically most design systems, and component libraries across the web have different glyph spaces for the indeterminate or checked. And basically when checked states are adjusted, basically they change the, check mark out in some way. So in order to light up the scenario that we were just talking about, being able to change it, all of the pseudo elements, all of the CSS properties, I would like to be able to, for you to be able to adjust, you wouldn't be able to detain aspects of display types, you wouldn't be able to adjust. So, and this is where I say pseudo elements are limited. Like you can come in and say, okay, well now I want to align self center. If like, assuming that you're in a flex or a grid layout, like, because you may not be, so that may not work. But with regards to the glyph specifically, I'm probably going to say it should be like a background image. And that, then the reason why that I find that valuable is a lot of the implementations are actually just painted. They're not even like graphics or SVGs. They're just direct render calls to
the checkbox is not a normal resource that you'd think of it as. It's like,
And so like what I'm trying to piggyback on there is, there is like the new paint API that basically came out of like CSS Houdini.
Right.
And so like that basically becomes an image. And so like what I'm going to propose is it be a background image is how this is implemented and spec that. And what that then means is technically, under the hood, they can still call their same render logic and it just, kind of maps back to that same, statement. But then that also allows like, your normal, CSS developer that, I go produce a, a PNG that has an alpha channel and, I'll throw it in a background image and cool, it works and it does what
I expect it to do. Which opens up a world of possibility. I mean, that would be amazing for designers.
Exactly.
Cool. I wonder though, if people want like animation, little pops and sizzles. I think of like material kind of has that, right? Like when you fill in their checkbox. So I wonder how that would all work, but it seems like a good first pass. But
yeah, like you would probably be able to do probably simple animations, but you wouldn't be able to be like, and again, it depends on how the, your container is implemented. But like one that's real quick that, I reference, in one of the talks I gave was, if you're on Amazon and you're typing in your password, they actually have the word show. And so like you with this one, you would have to insert an image for the word show, which is like really hokey. But then others I've seen like the like eyeball is outside of the password box field, And so like, let's take that scenario. Well, if I want to move the eyeball outside, like a common thing people would do is, I'll position absolute and I'll make it like right zero, and I'll make it so that the checkbox itself is position relative. But the thing is the like user agent may have said, hey, this input is overflow hidden and you can't touch that. At which point now your eyeball is gone. It's completely clipped. And so to your point of the animations, this is why I say pseudo elements are good and they get you, I would say they probably solve a good 50 to 75%, because I haven't actually done a study on this, but like they solve a good amount. Like if we supported widths and heights and said, hey, you can change the checkbox itself and you can change the border and, the gradients, you can do all of those things. But like, hey, like, unfortunately, we're probably going to need a next tier in order to light up, exactly what you may go do if you were to completely rebuild your own from scratch. Like, I still think it's a great first step because pseudo elements do require, unfortunately, that limitation. But it's a good foundation to build on top of, I guess, is my point.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I'd wonder about it, like with like a raster asset, I think you'd said no SVG, but like, you know, I would need, you know, different, you know, crisp graphics for even this new iPhone that's like 72 billion pixels or whatever.
No, it could be an SVG.
Crystal. Okay.
I just was saying it would need to be a, yeah, go ahead.
But then times theming, right? Like, because now we all have light modes, dark modes, and so.
And that is the benefit of like saying, "Hey, we're going to go." Because initially, the way we initially implemented the password, because we actually had a proposal for the password reveal, you know, at Edge, and the way that we implemented it was implemented as an SVG, and so the fill color would propagate in, so you could adjust like basically the glyph color. The problem is not all glyphs are created equal. And so do you need multiple glyph colors, you know, in order to achieve that? So like, if you end up like center eye is black and then you make it so like but the outside is, you know, a different color. And then you say, okay, well, I'm going to send in black. So now you can't actually even see an eyeball. Cause it depends on where I then decide to put that fill color. And then, and then in the inverse, like, okay, you want that complete control. You end up hitting what you just referenced. Like, I have dark modes. I want them to be able to change like a property in some admin panel, you know, of highlight color, and that'll change all my glyphs. Okay, well, now you're going to have to generate images on the fly because unfortunately at CSS time, you can't propagate in that information because it takes that SVG and like it rasters it, even if it's SVG. So you can't dynamically propagate those values into it.
I tried to do that last week. It didn't work. I just had to.
It would be
put
cool.
Two SVGs in. It's fine. It's fine.
Yeah, and like I said, I think it's a good step in the right direction. But you're quickly seeing how like pseudo elements, you kind of have to take. You have to choose a path. Like, you can't just have your cake and eat it too. Unfortunately, with pseudo elements, and that's why we're not stopping there.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Framer. That's framer.com/shoptalk. Go there, sign up for free, get 20% off any paid plan. That's very generous. Thank you, Framer. When you've spent hours designing something beautiful for the web, the last thing you want to hear is, oh, sorry, we can't build this. You know, what you need is a tool that bridges the gap between design and development. Framer can be that bridge. It's a browser-based prototyping tool that enables designers to use code-backed components and dynamic transitions to visually express ideas. So when the time comes that, you know, you perhaps as the designer are giving it to a developer, the developer can jump in and easily inspect the elements, get the CSS or the JSX right from there. Custom animations, custom built with Magic Motion. It's powered by Framer Motion, which is an open source library that's awesome. You should check out for React. It all comes with a complete clean code, which can be taken right from Framer and you can move it right into production. So it's the gap. It's the Framer is the bridge. So sign up for free or get 20% off any paid plan by visiting framer.com/shoptalk. That's framer.com/shoptalk. Well, we talked about it, the accessibility concerns a bit too, but Dave was also like, well, just NPM install it kind of thing. There's performance benefits here too. If you don't have to rebuild anything, you get some performance out of the page itself because it's just using the platform, as they say.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the future here. Like, let's say all the form elements get fixed. Like, do you have a date for that, Greg? Is it next year, next Tuesday?
Oh, goodness gracious. Yeah, I don't know.
But let's say they all get fixed. Like, I wonder if there's a bar where it's like good enough to where I don't need to bring in all my custom mumbo jumbo. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I wonder if it's going to be this, you open the genie out of the bottle and it's, oh, now they're good and I can style them. Now we've opened a whole industry of custom style components or something. I wonder what the future holds. Maybe both futures. I don't know.
I could see it being both. I would say when you were talking about good enough, I actually feel like I would say that is kind of our are good enough is probably not, I wouldn't say our goal. We actually just, we've done a ridiculous amount of time looking at all the use cases, you know, for the majority of the top pain point form controls, and have come up with a model that I think is a good kind of to the extreme, you know, along the spectrum. But also understanding we should come fill in like the pseudo elements, like we can get those out the door much faster, still unlocking use cases, but not unlocking all of them. And so like, I always like to think of like jQuery, like why did the majority of people reach for jQuery? And it was like, because, you know, it saved me four lines of like fetching a specific element and chaining things together. And it provided all this like roughly syntactic sugar around, JavaScript that I was having to write. And once they added, you know, query select or all and, you know, promises and stuff, it's like I've never ever needed or thought about jQuery, man, probably close to a decade now.
Yeah.
And so it's like you end up finding those, and that's kind of where that survey is kind of driving the direction of the top ones we'll focus on. And I think over time you will see people going, oh, okay, cool. Like, yeah, I don't need, you know, to bring in, you know, you may still bring in like a Bootstrap, but the hope would be Bootstrap is actually just using the native ones there. Right. And so like the libraries would change over time, and that's kind of the angle we're going. And that's kind of why, the open UIs of the world and everything have bring in the like component library authors and the wonderful like tab knowledge experts, such as Dave Rupert here, in hopes of like, making it so that it solves enough use cases that everybody, whether they be Bootstrap or, you know, material design or office, it doesn't really matter, can go leverage them.
You'd think the next, you know, generation of those things will be like, hey, you know, use these amazingly designed, incredibly beautiful checkboxes, and it's like 40 lines of CSS, you know, like that's it.
Yeah. And I wouldn't even say that they're, yeah, basically the goal, and to try to put it succinctly, the way that we kind of try to describe it is there is an implicit definition of controls on the web platform. But to I would say my surprise when I first started looking into this, there's actually no definition of a control, standardized definition. And so like what's interesting is actually all the controls on the web platform follow an MVC model. So for those that may not be aware of what that means, it's a model view controller. And if you do any type of form engagement or even components for that matter, you know that, hey, like, you know, the input has a value, you know, property hanging off of it. Well, that's part of its model. Like you update and change its model. You know, required is a part of its model. You know, is it required or is it not? You know, and then basically all of them have built-in kind of controller code. So the select example you referenced, like it has a button that when I click it, it changes a state of open. Granted, if you have like multiple, a lot of those are right into the page, so they don't have a button. But anyways, you're changing that controller code, and that controller code has a known understanding of what a select is. And it's like, I'm going to have options underneath of me. And so like when you press the keyboard arrow down, I'm going to traverse to the next option. You know, I'm going to highlight this thing that's selected. And then when you hit enter or click a mouse button, I'm going to update the value. And so what we're really trying to do is lean into like, let's fill out the model in the view, because when we go look at the majority of the, and I say the majority, like 80 to 85% of the use cases, they're wanting to slightly tweak the view. And so it's like, let's give them that capability to tweak the view to the extent that kind of goes to the extreme, but also, you know, define the behaviors as well. So when you do get into that 10% of people that like, no, I actually want to prevent default that you've got assigned to this button and take it over. They can do that as well. Ultimately, we want to be able to say, here's the defined anatomy, so the parts. Here's the defined behaviors and the states, but allow the author to change the view while also the UA is shipping a decent version. You know, and so you need to give that kind of switch of like, no, I want to go into this, you know, like, interoperable, where I want to reuse the behavior similar to what we were talking about with appearance none, because that's technically how appearance none is spec'd. We just haven't evolved to that next step of saying, okay, well, now let's go define all the parts, you know, and maybe a base style sheet that when you're in appearance none, everybody goes and falls back to this default DOM structure and default style sheet, to where then everything web developers have wanted is possible.
Mm. So the model would still say, like, the logic that makes a select box do a select box, that would still be there, but it's kind of like, now it's just basic HTML that is on the view. that's what the view spits out. It doesn't spit out the like weirdo custom or like what no, OS exactly. dependent replaced element thing.
Yeah. I mean, it would still be probably technically a replaced element, but we're defining everything in like Shadow DOM terms. So it would be like Shadow DOM-esque, except for the fact they wouldn't be like, they would already be pre-known to the browser. But like, it's kind of interesting in introducing you to an extent to web components. And this is the thing we haven't defined fully yet. Like, it may just be we actually go define all the pseudo elements for the parts rather. But I mean, we do have the part attribute, for example. And so we do have like, you know, a capability of saying, you know, :: part function and like referencing that part. So we may just lean into that rather than standardize everyone.
That's literally a part of the web component, whatever spec or API or whatever you call it. So these are for the form controls of today are web components?
No.
The
form controls today are... Oh, goodness gracious, dude. It really depends on which form control you're talking about, which engine.
But they could be
all over the map. Maybe that is kind of what we're looking towards. And like, I'll end up sending you guys the link, and I recommend referencing it. It is a read, so grab some coffee. But it delves in very deep into like how I would say we're looking at that more extreme bucket, because we wanted the full picture while also understanding we want to check off some smaller boxes along the way.
Yeah.
And so like the, it basically gets into that full anatomy, and it's leveraging basically what was defined web components, because ultimately web components were actually just defining what the browser already did, because a replaced element, they actually had HTML underneath of those. So like you take a input type range.
It's a shadow DOM.
We don't. Kinda. Yeah, exactly. Like we do it. We have a bunch of HTML underneath of it. We just surface to the, you know, to the DOM that it's just an input type range, but. It's just HTML and CSS underneath of that. In a lot of the cases, some of the cases, it's like I said, it's, you know, custom render calls to the, so.
I would think web component activists would be excited about that too. If there was more of them native to the browser, that would get people more excited about using them themselves for building other things. I don't know.
And I think this again goes back into the like, my hope. Yes, I would love to leverage web components and make them be native. My also hope is down the road, again, since so many of the web components people build are just these, they would actually maybe we would need less actual building of components. They would they would actually not need to go build the web components themselves. And so the components you would end up seeing are ones that aren't actually native yet, but maybe down the road. So like you may be building out like a carousel component or something like that. But
yeah. Well, if web components could extend other web components, which they kind of can,
yeah,
that'd be pretty rad. Oh, okay. Well, I want to get to this because you've said the word open UI a few times, but we haven't really defined it. The URL there being open-ui.org looks like, I don't know, there's a lot here, but like, for example, along the sidebar, you can click to the select element in there and it just gets way into select. So if we're just mouth blogging and we're like, okay, a select, whatever, it's open or closed, it can be multiple or not. I don't know. Seems pretty simple, right? This does a good job of showing kind of the deeper anatomy of a select and showing you just how complicated a select can be. Is that the point of this, or what's the...
So OpenUI is like I was saying there, you know, there was like seven teams I spoke with at, you know, Microsoft, you know, Salesforce has one. Basically, all it's trying to do is there has never been a standardized place for what controls or components are and like how they're actually defined. And because of that, like controls are an interesting thing, because controls and components, both of them, because they actually span the entire web platform. And so like, basically there's been like piecemeal attempts. So like CSS has added pseudo elements, which gets you some things, but not all things. And then HTML has certain things. So like the one I like to point to the most is details and summary, where it actually starts defining the anatomy. It'll be like details has a summary. And like when a summary is clicked, it propagates to the details and it takes this event and it changes. So basically right there, you're saying, here's the anatomy and the behaviors, but it then doesn't go and say, by the way, we're going to make sure that all of them have these parts, and these parts are referenced via pseudo elements and CSS. So like, again, they're not taking the entire picture. And so what that ends up doing is every single component library design system teams out there that exist come up with a design. They end up producing what a lot of them refer to as blueprints, which is basically what OpenUI is trying to follow. And it's actually allowing the web component design system that like to kind of drive the direction of this. And this is something we quickly saw in the Chromium stuff. So many of the questions we were asking, we would actually turn to our component library authors and say, like, what did you all do? Because we don't, on the web platform, we don't build them every day. Like, we're not constantly in this world. And so, like, they'll have, like, user research of, hey, you know, in Office, we saw this, like, from end users. Mm-hmm. So, like, here's the best experience, you know, and here's the best way to do that control. And so, like, we didn't just want to stay in the web platform silo and pretend that the web platform folks are the smartest and most brilliant. And so, like, that's actually why I'm really excited about this, because of the fact that it gets us out of the just even the component library. So, like, let's pretend none of this ends up in the web platform. Obviously, we all hope that that does. But just even that, everybody getting together and sharing that knowledge of saying, hey, we're all going to work on this blueprint together, share knowledge, share expertise. Because when you go look across the landscape, people like to posit that their controls and components are so drastically different when it's not the case at all. Like 80 to 85% of them like overlap. There may be like one obscure one that does something drastically different, but the models and the anatomies are like almost a one-to-one in most cases.
So you're kind of proving that here. You're like, look, here's how a single input worked. This is how it's done in semantic UI. This is how it's done in Ant design. This is how it's done in Material or UI Fabric or whatever. Look, they're all the same. Look.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just, and again, like the CSS working group actually just, you know, had, you know, somebody was like, hey, let's standardize the file pseudo elements that exist across browsers. And it's like, okay, cool. So let's like do the research on that. And we have an open PR that'll land here soon for the anatomy of that. But basically, it's like, let's do the research and just make sure we're not designing ourselves into a corner, because the only reason we want to add this stuff is so that people use them for all the end user benefits you noted earlier with regards to, you know, accessibility and performance and all of those things. So if we don't unlock that, then people aren't going to use it. So let's not waste our time specking nor implementing pseudo elements that don't drive us towards that.
The biggest design systems in the world here that you're referencing. So if you reference all of them together, the chances are you're going to get it right.
Well, and then on top of that, like, we are always looking for more design systems. We don't want to pretend that, even if it's not a design system, it's just, hey, I, you know, use the same, you know, select button on every single one of my sites. And I only happen to, you know, I'm a person of one, a team of one, which I've been in the past at some, you know, web dev shops. It's like, please include that as well. Like, we want to make sure all the use cases, you know, are covered. So like, I don't want to diminish ones that are, you know, more one-off, but it, like, yeah, you quickly see the Venn diagram is drastically overlapping. And even ones when people will bring up, so for example, a lot of people bring up the iOS scroll wheel to me, for example. And it's like, again, like we could make it a code pen challenge of like, everybody go, leveraging the model and the controller of a select, you know, design ones. And like, I've built, you know, radial ones for watch faces. I've built the scroll wheel one because the model's the same. You get N plus options. And so like, sure, I have a window that's positioned fixed that takes up 60% of the viewport, you know, and it's at the bottom. And so like, okay, well now let's add in, you know, touch gestures to make it scroll.
So yeah. What Greg's talking about is you open up a select on iOS. The experience is not at all like desktop where you see this little menu and you just pick the one in it.
Slot machine.
Yeah. Ugh. You go to Vegas for a minute and you spin them around.
Yeah. And so it's like, I'm really trying to, and that's kind of why we were saying like, ultimately you want to get to the point where every behavior is defined, because you then do want to be able to have people say, well, I want to like on that touch event, I want to prevent default because I do want to do something a little different. And then that next stage, this is what's beautiful, as I met with the ARIA working group about this, because if you, every single one of these component libraries and design system teams, like I said, goes to HTML specifications, CSS specifications, CSS tricks, Stack Overflow, who like you name it, to put together this blueprint on how best to build out this design that they've been handed. And then they also go to ARIA best practices. And the thing that I can't stand, I love that it exists, but the thing that's so unfortunate is the design system or component library author now has to go through and do an algorithm in their head. Because if you go through and read them, they're like, sometimes they may have this at the top. If that is the case, then you do this. Sometimes they may be this. If that, then reference down here, do that. Mm. And it's like, once you define the parts, which again, CSS pseudo elements already do, certain HTML elements start going down that road as well. Once you define the parts, you can get very concrete about the states and start getting into the controller code. You can start saying, here are the behaviors that are tied to these parts and here are the implications. So like when this is clicked, you're going to change ARIA role or you're going to change, all those different capabilities, which then you have a spec for, which then allows, the web developers of the world to come in and say, oh, this part has, a on-click event, a listener tied to it. So I can then just hijack that for my needs on this part. And so, it just becomes very powerful. And like I said, even if they don't end up in the web platform, it's getting all these experts that do this daily showing, if you're going to go build your own, the best way to do it backed on user research, based on, real usage on top web properties as well.
And there's some things like OpenUI. One of my favorite pages is the component name matrix, where you just like list what components are in each design system and like what they're called to try to, I guess it's kind of the idea probably that like abstract what this thing is called across a bunch of things. But some of these would probably, like we've talked about these interactive elements, like, checkboxes, selects, and I'm kind of into tabs right now, but mm-hmm. There's probably things that are fairly ubiquitous, like badge, which probably doesn't need an element, right? Like that's just
a span.
A span. Yeah. Right. With the background color. But
yeah. And that's, I love that you brought that up because basically the initial goal here was actually, let's take those seven teams at Microsoft and across the industry and try to make them one. Like, let's just try to just leverage the knowledge base. And yes, we will probably end up with 30 or 40 components across that left side. And I don't expect 30 or 40 new elements in the web platform. But I'm totally cool with somebody coming forward and saying, you know what? Like, let's stop pretending there aren't 80% of web traffic getting this element. And so like, while yes, you're correct, a badge is a span, like it also comes with like this ARIA semantics and this expectation and going back to the Braille reader, like I just feel like it should just be on a case by case. Like, is there a strong reason to put it in there? And we actually already have one. So like if you, along the left side, you'll see that there's a skeleton component, and every design system and component library out there, pretty much the majority of them have a skeleton component. But we can't define an anatomy for it because it drastically differs. Like some of them, like if you think of like a financial site, they'll be like stock charts, and then another, like it'll look like, kind of like Facebook where it's got an avatar with, some stuff. Mm. And so it's like, basically it's a div, honestly. Like if you get down to it, like
right. I
mean, the only thing we could define would be a container. That said, there are ARIA benefits to a skeleton of doing it right. Like there's an ARIA busy, and we actually went to the ARIA working group and we're like, hey, should we have a new role for this? Because it's wildly there. It basically, we can come up with a way to accomplish this for accessibility, but we like, maybe we should just make it a role because it is so ubiquitous. And they were like, no, just recommend these two different properties. I don't remember them off the top of my head. These two different attributes. And ultimately, that's okay. Like OpenUI, some of these, it may just be, hey, if you're new on a design system team and you want to know what just the definition of a skeleton is, like we may not be able to find enough overlap or enough meaningful content, but hey, at least we still have a definition of what it means, which is okay. Again, like, So OpenUI is kind of going that full spectrum, taking it case by case and saying, what is the 80-90% overlap? Let's get a blueprint in there for that. And then also, hey, like Dave referenced tabs. I think that's a great example of one. Let's get it in here. And I can see us being able to walk over to, WhatWig and say, hey, like we've done all the research. Here's how it should behave. Here's how it should work. We're going to submit a PR for a tabs element. And here's the parts that should be applied to them. And then we can also have the same discussion of, should we have pseudo elements for these or should they be elements? You know what I mean?
Right.
So that's kind of the flow that we kind of expect it to take. And Dave is helping work on the tabs one. So I'm super excited to see that come through and lend his expertise there.
Yeah, I could see a new HTML element working for that, although that's a whole
for sure
can of worms here. But I like the idea that the skeleton wouldn't be it, because there's other things that get involved here. I was just kind of reading about this new CSS thing called containment, or like there's containment, but there's also one that's like, I forget. There's a couple of different ones involved. And if like if there happened to be an HTML element named skeleton, which I cannot see the day that that would happen, but maybe, you know, that then it would be your job then to rip it entirely out of the DOM and replace it with a div or whatever else comes in when the skeleton is no longer needed. And that's going to be problematic for reflow and stuff. And now the CSS property that you've just applied to this thing because you want it to, I don't know, have better performance for layout. Mm-hmm. Is moot because you just ripped it the hell out of the DOM and replaced it with something else. You know, like it's not just accessibility. There's other concerns as well.
I would think. Yeah.
Okay. So that's OpenUI. Very interesting. Again, open-ui.org. We'll get you there. There's an explainer. It's all very interesting research here. Very cool.
And please, people, get involved. Like I said, we want anybody that's willing to engage. If you build form controls, like, it's a community group. We have a Discord channel. Even if it's just to jump in there and tell us we totally screwed up on anatomies for certain things, by all means. It's pretty lightweight.
I could even use a primary. Like, is that the best way to get involved? Like, hop into the Discord? Or is there...
So GitHub. GitHub issues is probably the best spot. But we have a biweekly call. And like I said, I'm trying to really let the... because I have years of standards experience. And this is one thing that I would love for OpenUI to potentially crack, which is I'm trying to let the component library and authors tell me what makes most sense for them with engagement here. And it's because I don't want it to get so bogged down into like, hey, you know, process, you know, historically. And so like, yeah, we have a Discord channel, which is like sort of unique in the W3C. And then like, we just have a massive Zoom call that I just send out to everybody on the Discord channel. So like, we may end up with people that have never been in a standards meeting. So like, the Discord channel is a great place to kind of stay up on things, you know, but GitHub issues, like go scroll through there. But yeah, if you jump on there, ping me. I have an office hours, you know, normally on Fridays where I'm just more than happy to jump on and just chat and help people get started. So yeah, the Discord channel is great.
And this is something like the W3C or what working group or whatever. They're like aware of this initiative and are they kind of bought into the process?
Yes.
Or not quite yet?
I actually, this was a really risky, really risky scheduling of this call because last Monday I really wanted to have a, kind of, I wouldn't say hold everybody's feet to the fire, but kind of like get as many people from the different web platform places in one spot, because over the past 3 months, we've had numerous form control discussions on the CSS working group, and basically they end up being meta discussions, you know, like what about interoperability, this, that, and the other. And it has nothing to do with the actual, like either pseudo element or property we're talking about. And so like, basically we had the meeting, I think I've shared the video with you all. We'll be able to put it in the links or whatever, but it basically walks through the problem. And I wanted everybody, like, when we literally have it minuted in the official minutes of like, yes, this is a problem and we should help try to solve it. And then also like say, hey, you know, like we don't only want to start from the far right, like, and this is one thing that I would love to like get into deeper at some point with someone, but it's like, I feel like the pendulum has swung way too far. You know, when the web started, we had like all this magic and then it became, okay, let's describe the platform. So they moved to basically all JavaScript land to do everything down there. And we got a few benefits, like, you know, we have Flex and Grid and like some things that like, hey, if I want to come from the more, I just want to be in front end, but I don't want to be like a hardcore JavaScript developer. I kind of want to come from that way too. And that's kind of where the pseudo elements and like the hints kind of become valuable, but also understand the far right as well, but take the direction from the left, because I think that's where we'll solve the majority of use cases and get them the most usage. So that Monday meeting was great because we literally had a representative from every browser vendor. We had people from the accessibility working group there as well, because they had showed that like I had thrown out the, you know, the holy grail for me would be to get rid of ARIA best practices. Cause like once we get to the parts and behaviors, we can actually just have unit tests for all these components. And so they were like, oh my gosh, that would be heaven if we could get there. So like, so I wanted everybody there. I made sure to get as many component libraries and design system authors on the call as well. And so like, basically there was a lot of agreed upon OpenUI will be where form control discussions and components happen. And so like, for example, Miles from Apple brought up, hey, you know, I want a font picker control. So like, we're now going to like use that as kind of like a good example of like, hey, I want a new control on the web platform. You bring it to OpenUI. We do the, you know, the anatomy, the definitions, the standardize of the behaviors, all that kind of stuff. And then you take that next step of, okay, well, now let's take it to WhatWig. Now that like we've engaged with, you know, you have office.com, you know, on the call. Like, yeah, they would probably, you know, have good insight into what a font picker would need to have, right? You know, in Word and Outlook. So thrilled how that meeting went.
Yeah, no, that's, I guess, yeah, that's sort of the make sure that people are interested or like, I don't, you know.
It's, yeah, browser vendors,
cool.
Pretty
it's
much.
It's cool. It's fun to have meetings, but if they,
yes,
if people don't care about the outcome, that's different. So, but that sounds like people care. So,
yeah,
let's do a real quick zinger for Greg because he's, you know, Greg's a connected guy. He knows people who knows people. You know.
Yeah.
So let's say you, Greg, were like had a, some. You were a company that rhymed with like Blazilla, and. massive layoffs recently, and you, being Greg, have lived at a company that went through a Chromium transition, and largely it was presented to the world as a very positive thing. Could you imagine being at Blazilla and deciding that we're also going to make that transition? Do you see a company like Blazilla going Chromium?
Oh goodness gracious! I appreciate this question. You know what? I can. And I feel like we could use another hour because I actually don't feel this is as dangerous as a lot of people. Like the whole single browser engine statement.
You heard it here first, Greg. Blazilla is going Chrome.
No. I wouldn't be shocked just because. And you know what's funny? David Story, I'll give him a shout out. When we went to the new Edge and we focused on interop and not Chromium, when we started, you know, focusing on interop and doing all the WebKit stuff, he was like, we're going to move to Chromium in a few years. And I was like, what? No, we're not. And he's like, no, this is exactly how Opera went. The second that you're implementing somebody else's properties, it's the beginning of the end. And sure enough, like, I mean, he was right. And so like you end up having to like spend so much time treading water that like, you want to advocate for web developers and make innovations, and Firefox and Mozilla still is, or Blazilla, as you say, still is. But like, yeah, with all the layoffs and the momentum, and then you drop in Microsoft into Chromium, like, I mean, the speed at which things are going to move is just going to, you know, exponentially increase. And so, like, again, I would love to have another discussion on the whole like browser engine, is that harmful for the web thing? Because I can easily come back from my Edge HTML days and make arguments that it is important to have diversity and a willingness to downstream implement in a different way. But that's a whole nother hour and I don't want to take up your time.
I love those conversations too, but I'm afraid the Shop Talk audience is only subjected to that once every couple of months. So.
Yeah, we'll have to take it to the blogs this time. Greg, thanks so much for coming on the show. For people who aren't following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
Giving me money, give it to a charity of your choice. And I don't know if Shop Talk has one, by all means, link to one. And then Twitter is at Greg Willworth, GitHub's at Greg Willworth. And then, OpenUI is OpenUICG on Twitter.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcast of choice. Hopefully you're energized about the potential to style select elements. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one because people want to hire people like you and Chris. You got anything else you'd like to say?
Open select. Go to shoptalkshow.com. Close select. Yeah, sorry, I forgot that. I'm gonna have to reference OpenUI to get the correct API.
White screen. All right. All right.